I believe we are live. So welcome everyone to another episode of the world's best social work show. I'm Ernesto from Social Work Mentor, and I'm happy to be here for episode 3 with my super awesome co-host. This is a bi-weekly show about social work related themes and topics from a variety of different social work lenses. Sometimes we have 4, 5, 6 people, sometimes a little less. But
Ernesto, I don't think you're recording.
Oh, it says live on my end.
It's live
does
on
it?
My end.
Yeah.
Oh, mine does not say that. Sorry. Mine's just scheduled.
Well,
see, there folks, we go. Now it says it's live.
All right. This is the kind of fun we have here week to week. There's been sorry so far, that. Just in case you haven't seen it yet, this is the third week of the show, and this is the third week of technical difficulties. But we're social workers, and we're going to trudge through, and we're going to make it work. So just to get an idea of who those social workers are that are with me here this week. Oh, as I was mentioning, sometimes we have 4, 5, 6 of us, but people have, as we know, as social workers, they have crises or taking some self-care time. And so it varies, but no matter who's here, it's always going to be interesting. So to get an idea of who we have today, we'll introduce ourselves, and I'll go ahead and introduce myself first, just because I'm talking now. My name, as I mentioned, is Ernesto. You might know me from Social Work Mentor on Facebook or Instagram, TikTok, all the different places. I've been a social worker for 25 years now in a lot of different roles, a lot of different positions, and I'm on the West Coast of the United States in California. So that's a little bit about me. Just as I see you on my screen, Destry, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself? And then Sabrina?
Yes. So I'm Destry. I am a social worker as well. I'm a dual licensed social worker. So I have the licensure for 2 different states to work in. I'm located in the Midwest. My primary career focus has been child welfare with direct client interaction, so doing child protection assessments. I've also done some adoption work in refugee resettlement, so I got a little bit of experience, but primarily child welfare. And you can find me on TikTok at Destrio, and lots of fun on there talking about child welfare topics and social work in general.
All right, thanks, Sabrina.
I'm Sabrina. You can find me at Sabrina in Social Work on TikTok and a little bit on Instagram. I work in the macro space. So I do social services administration. I tend to focus a lot on policy, both workplace policy as well as state, federal, and local policy work. And I also have the direct practice background in mental health, disabilities, and homeless services. So happy to be here.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. Happy to have the two of you here this week. And so just a quick reminder for people, if you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, or LinkedIn right now live, you can send us comments or questions using the chat feature on that platform, and we'll do our best to put your comment up or your question and address it. If you're listening or if you're watching the recorded version, you can always send us questions, feedback, ideas for topics you'd like to hear us talk about to info@socialworkmentor.com. So got that stuff out of the way. So we can go ahead and get started on our topics for this week. We have a couple of topics. Usually we've been having, like 3 topics, right? But we found that we want to try a little different format that allows us to maybe go a little bit deeper and also cut down on the time so it's manageable for people that want to watch and listen. So I'm going to attempt, without technical difficulties, hopefully, to share my screen as an introduction to our first topic. The name of the topic here that we have is mental health care in marginalized communities, just for a little context. So let me see if I can get this done, and then we'll go from there. Here we go, share system audio. All right, I'm assuming we can all see that.
Yep,
we're good. All right, now let's hope that we can hear it. Here we go.
First of all, even talking about this, having this conversation in communities of color, Indigenous communities, can be really hard because we come from, a lot of us come from communities where talking about mental health is stigmatized. In my view, this is also a byproduct of colonization, imperialism, enslavement, experiences where our cultural practices were co-opted. Because if you take a look at the historical underpinning or roots of a lot of the ancient indigenous lineages we come from, our ancestors knew to engage in practices to keep our mental and physical health in the best place possible. Our people knew, our ancestors knew to avail practices like yoga, like pranayama, breathing, mindfulness practices, tai chi, drumming, chanting, indigenous practices. Like, I could go on and on about how our ancestors knew this, but because of experiences related to colonization and more, a lot of mental health experiences, or the experience of mental health, has been vilified.
All right, so hopefully that provides just a little intro to the topic that we're going to talk about. And the question, I guess, that we'll start with, and I'll open it up to one of you, is what are some of the challenges and or solutions to this issue? So as the YouTube video talked about, you know, there's stigmas that are in many marginalized communities, or I'm going to also just say that not only marginalized communities, sometimes it's just any community, just people, there's stigma. So I'll preface it with that. And now if either of you has any thoughts about the challenges that exist or solutions to them. Don't fight over the mic.
I can go. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of challenges and a lot of barriers. And I was actually really excited to hear what Sabrina's going to say, because from my perspective, I really think the barriers that we have are related to like structural determinants of health. And a lot of that is influenced by policy and procedure and the laws that we have. So her macro lens, I think, will be really interesting to hear on this topic. But I think so much of like these historical deep-rooted racism and the cycle that we've created has just created such a barrier for marginalized communities, which are usually made up of minorities, to access mental health care. And even when they do access it, I think then we run into the issue of implicit bias and how that's impacting the care that they're receiving. I mean, I know like people of color are usually more likely to be misdiagnosed, versus like just having like depression, anxiety, they're sometimes more diagnosed with like psychotic disorders. It's just, so there's all these barriers and confusion and judgments that are just kind of swirling around. And I think it's really led to a very ineffective mental health system for our marginalized communities. And so I guess that's kind of my thought, but yeah, I would really love to hear from Sabrina and her policy perspective. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a lot there in what you shared with that. So yeah, let's see what the lens that Sabrina brings to us here with her thoughts on the topic.
Yeah, Destry, you just hit on like so many different things that I literally just pulled out a notebook to be like, okay, I have to remember like hit on any of those that I can. So I would say that access obviously is kind of like one of the biggest issues. One of the things that we know is that, number one, even if you do have health insurance, a lot of times mental health services are not included. Mm-hmm. So we have that piece where there's, and part of Obamacare was that it should be included. It's called mental health parity. So all substance use disorder treatment, as well as mental health treatment, should be treated exactly like healthcare in any other setting. Unfortunately, none of the mechanisms were funded to actually keep track of who is providing this and who's not providing it. And so if your insurance company isn't actually paying for it, or you have a $50 copay instead of a $10 copay like you normally do, it just becomes inaccessible. It's also really hard for individual therapists to do things like take Medicaid, because billing takes a bazillion years and there's a lot of issues there. And so if you have folks who are receiving Medicaid, you have to find a provider that's going to take Medicaid. And that's really hard. Again, there's that parity issue where I know a lot of folks would love to provide services with, you know, Medicaid reimbursement, but usually therapists can only take so much Medicaid reimbursement is like another issue. And like on top of that, we have a lot of folks can't even receive services. Like particularly I'm thinking about kids in foster, you know, who are in foster care systems. You can't receive services until you are literally in foster care. And then it's required for you to be able to like make all these meetings. And there's also just kind of like the idea that going to a therapist physically once a week, once every other week is really hard for folks that, for any folk that, any person that is lower income who might have transportation yeah. issues, work. There's it's like,
sorry to interrupt so many
pieces. Me, yeah, no, go for it.
This, so to your point about coming into the system for children to get services, I don't know if you've experienced this or witnessed this, Destry, but I've seen where sometimes there have been social workers who know that a family needs to have some of these issues addressed, but they don't have the means without coming into the system. So they literally will bring them in. They've brought them into the child welfare system in order to get the services mm-hmm. that they need to address some of the issues, because without coming into the system, like you said, they're not going to receive those services and they're going to stay out there unserved. So I don't, have you experienced that, Destry, or?
So not necessarily. I will say that I think, well, being in the Midwest, we're normally more conservative. And so I think that kind of falls into like limit, like we don't, like there's a huge push in our area not to have placements. Like you do not want to place kids in foster care, which I think is a good thing. So I've actually never had a situation where a kid has needed services. We have a lot of contracts set up in this region that as long as they are working, like they don't have to be in foster care to, like we have a lot of contracts set up for in-home therapy and ABA services and MST therapy. I mean, all these different things that we just have a really good partnership with. And so we're usually, for the most part up here, able to connect them. I will say that there has been a barrier where a family is like right above the cutoff for Medicaid, mm-hmm. but they can't afford private insurance. Well, if they come into foster care, yeah, then they'll get Medicaid and then they can get it, you know, assistance mm-hmm. for services. And so, you know, I try to like, I mean, could that have been an easy way to get services? Yeah. But I also know that that's just going to create this snowball effect, because kids who come into care have poorer mental health outcomes, less likely to graduate. Yep. They're less likely to, you know, go to college. I mean, to have employment. They're more likely to be homeless, involved in human trafficking. There's so many more negative things that I feel like I'd rather try to do something else.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that that it's common practice that I've witnessed, yep. But I have witnessed it more.
Yeah,
and
me
like
too.
You said, we have a much, in the past 5 years or at least, a much bigger push to keep kids out of placements, to keep mm-hmm. families out of the systems and find, you know, family or relatives or you know, people that can serve to have as placements and not bring them into the system. But like I said, over the past 20, 25 years, I have seen that with social workers who, for whatever reason, the intention being to get family served and maybe not thinking about those unintended consequences that could happen. So that was just a little side. I'm sorry for interrupting, Sabrina.
No, I think, I mean, and obviously, like, I can't speak from any BIPOC experience directly. But I know that there is a lot of stigma where if you're talking about going to, you know, just kind of even the conversations you see on TikTok where like people are like, we're working through our trauma because our parents refused to work through their trauma. And the parents are like embarrassed even of like their adult children going to therapy or, you know, concerned about like, what are they going to talk about? And so, I mean, I think therapy in general, mental health services in general are pretty significantly stigmatized, but we also don't have access in like really healthy ways where the biggest mental health provider in LA County, and I'm sure it's for a lot of places, is the prison. It's the prison system. And so if that's your experience with therapeutic services, like that's not where you're going to want to, you know, have your first roundabout with therapy. And if it is, it's an overworked caseworker. It's an overworked therapist who has 100 other folks on their caseload and really can't provide the services well. And so like, do you really want to go back to that? Like, it probably wasn't that effective. And so I think that that's like, it, you know, obviously just kind of like continues to add to reasons people wouldn't want to participate in therapeutic services, in mental health services.
Yeah. And I'll say, I mean, I don't think I've shared this in the first few weeks, but I consider myself a Chicano or Latino. That's kind of how I identify. So I do have some of that experience. I'm third and a half, fourth generation in the United States. But I work within the, you know, the immigrant community and the Latino community in general quite often. And so I have had some experiences. So I wanted to share a little anecdote about early in my career. We had a youth group and there was a youth who did some drawings. And this was way before what we know now with all the shootings and stuff like that. This was like in the mid 90s around there. And so a kid that we were working with had done some drawings, very explicit, very specific. And so we actually brought in the parents to talk with them and see how we would work through this. And, you know, the response, it was just, I remember clearly, it was just repeated. The only response they had was, mi hijo no es loco, mm-hmm. which is my son is not crazy. My son is not crazy. That, like, that was their only thing that they could respond. And we tried to explain, you know, that that's not what we're saying. There's, you know, he's an adolescent, he had some issues, but, you know, we were trying to social work it, but they really were just stuck in that thought of the stigma of, you know, what it might mean in their church community or in their neighborhood to have a son that was going to therapy, that was receiving services. And so, you know, that was a very challenging situation, but it illustrates just the, you know, the how strong that is in that dynamic, that phenomena in the Latino or other communities as well, other traditional communities or other communities in general. The other thing I wanted to say also was that looking historically from that same kind of, you know, either indigenous or African-American or Latino lens, you know, there were times throughout history where it was dangerous to be a parent or a child in those communities, because for whatever reason, you could have your child just literally taken away or beaten, or you could be beaten or whatever. So the more you could just kind of stay off the radar and just not, you know, ruffle any feathers, not cause any commotion or problems, it was going to increase the likelihood that you could keep your family intact. And so, you know, that's why, you know, sometimes the parenting practices reflected that reality for them. And so for someone to kind of come out and look for services, or generationally later on down the line with that same kind of mentality, for someone to expose themselves to that kind of intervention into a family unit, those historical scars are still there. And so it's not easy to trust that getting help for their child or someone in the family or themselves is not going to end up being something that, you know, immigration gets involved or child welfare or whatever. So it goes really deep, and it's a very real historical reality for a lot of communities.
Yeah. There's also just sorry.
No, you're totally.
I was just gonna say, there's also just the fact that like most therapists are white and overwhelmingly female in the US. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're looking at any stat, it's anywhere between like, you know, 69 and 79% of therapists in the US are white. And so the fact that there's that extra level of, you know, is this person culturally competent? And this person probably doesn't quite understand where I'm coming from and what my experiences are. And so how can they help me? Like, that's a very real question. Mm-hmm. But again, going back to that cultural competence piece, like there are so many really fantastic books written about how mental illness manifests itself in other communities and kind of what that means. So I don't know if you guys, what was the book? It was like something about falling. And it was a kid from Laos who had a seizure disorder. Did you guys read this book?
I haven't read that, but
I don't remember the name of it, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
I'll figure it out by the end. It'll pop in my head. But it's this really great book about how this Laotian child had a seizure disorder. His family had just come from Laos and everyone wanted to treat it. You know, the medical, you know, medical model, we need to treat this because this is a bad thing. But in their culture, if you have this seizure disorder, you are considered like anointed. And it's like a holy experience because it's like a genetic thing in this subculture in Laos, in like this very tiny community. And so like, that's the anointed one. So when you go to try to fix that child, that feels real bad to the people who think that their child is, you know, who believe in all honesty and earnestness that like their belief system is that like their kid is special and you want to take that out of their kid. And so, you know, there's just also that piece too. Like there's a lack of cultural competency and you're never going to know all of those things too, right? Like there's never an ability for me to learn all of the different cultures and I can, you know, do the most reading. I can have, you know, I can engage in, you know, multicultural communities. You know, I've worked, when I was in DC, I predominantly worked with the Black community in DC who were like born and raised there, like fifth generation. So they had to teach me so much about what that is like that, again, I will never be able to fully get. So I could see like going to me for therapy where I did case management, but I, you know, I was like, well, I am not going to be the best therapist for you, you know? So I think there's some humility in that too for therapists.
Yeah. I think that's such a, it's frustrating to me when I think about it, because I know a lot of therapists or social workers or school, you know, counselors that are in the work. For the most part, I always believe, you know, believe that they have the best intentions and that's why they do this work. But like you said, that piece about cultural competence / cultural humility, it's just like a barrier or even implicit bias. Those barriers that sometimes people are not even aware of how that's showing up for the person across from them. It's frustrating to me because I know they want to do good or do well, do good, whatever it is. This is not a grammar show, but you know, whatever those barriers are, it's like they can't see them because they're just, they don't know what they don't know. And so it's frustrating that exists. But I think those topics, cultural humility, cultural competence, implicit bias, keep an eye out, folks, if you're watching or listening, because those could be topics for upcoming shows that we could go on forever. So we've talked a lot about the issues and there's much more we could talk about, but what about, do either of you have, I don't want to put anyone on the spot, so I'll leave it open, have any ideas about maybe some solutions or different approaches, or maybe Sabrina, maybe you've seen or are aware of policies or things coming down the pike that or best practices that that we can start thinking about in terms of trying to decrease that stigma or increase access to services?
I'll just say there is so much money right now and so many plans for this huge workforce of clinicians that does not exist. And I keep looking at these policies. I'm like, where do you people think they are coming from? You are not paying anybody enough to do this work. And in addition to that, there's no pipeline. So I am seeing a ton of legislation, honestly. NASW just sent out an advocacy alert today for Excellence in Mental Health Act, which I was working on in 2013. So it shows how quick policy works. I worked on that for years.
Not quite a decade.
So. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Close. Yeah.
I had a friend who was working on a version of Obamacare since the beginning of his career, and he was 60 by the time it got passed. So he literally worked on it for 35 years, like this same piece of legislation. So the policy world is slow. But even crazy. Like in LA County, there was a bunch of funds and they were like, we are putting social workers and counselors in school. We're going to get 10,000 new social workers and counselors in schools. And I was just like, from where? Who? Like, we don't magically appear. We need, like, there's schooling, there is licensure, there is like all of this like prep work to get to that workforce. And let's face it, no one's actually investing in that workforce to like be able to pay them well, or for them to get good, you know, to get scholarships so that they can be in this pipeline. So I literally have no idea where they think all of these clinicians are coming from. It's not like everyone doesn't have a job and they're all just sitting, twiddling their thumbs, waiting for like some politician something to say do. Like, magically, we're going to pay you $50,000 in your city where it costs, you know, $2,800 to rent. Like, what are you people doing?
On the low end.
Yeah. That's so sad to me and so frustrating, because I feel like so much of the solution lies in policy change, especially when we look at like our social welfare and our welfare system, how it's so paternalistic and we punish people. Like, if you don't work hard enough, we're going to take away your assistance. But if you work too hard, we're taking away your assistance. And it's like, how do you change any of that?
Without, and now you're going to have less money than you had when you just had assistance.
Exactly. So it's just like, it makes no sense. And it's so discouraging to hear how flipping long it actually takes for those policies to churn out. And it makes me feel, and this is bad because I'm usually very optimistic, but I'm like, there's no hope in sight. That is how I feel sometimes. How sad is that?
That was, you know, honestly, like there were during Affordable Care, not Affordable Care Act, hello. During all of the like ARPA stuff and all of the American Rescue Plan Act, like when all of those dollars were coming through, mm-hmm. at one point I like literally cried because there was like legislation that I had been working on for like 8 years, 9 years, 10 years that like finally came to fruition, and it's already like they've already gotten rid of it in that 6 months. And I was like, we did, like there was such a collective sigh from those of us who've been working in these issue areas for like a decade, and we were so excited. And then it wasn't. This one in particular I'm thinking of is like the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit being monthly and being increased and being fully refundable and all of that, and we were just like screaming for joy, and then it literally lasted 6 months, and now they're back to like, nope, we're not doing that anymore, even though it pulled like 27% of kids that were in poverty are now out of poverty because of that, and they already stopped it. So policy is infuriating.
To be kind of to kind of speak to that issue of like that feeling of hopelessness and like it's never going to happen, and also to be kind of controversial and make the show a little interesting, I will posit that perspective is coming from a Eurocentric perspective, that treatment is only, you know, we have to wait for policy and therapist and school, those structures, because one of the things that possibly is a solution, and I see it happening here in my community, is partnering with you know, more of those natural supports that don't look like traditional therapy. It's not a therapist. There's no license. There's no policy. There's none of that. There's a church, or there's an elder, or there's a community group or a neighborhood gathering, or things that look very untraditional. I mean, in some ways you can, obviously there's some structure that needs to be put on it, but you can look at like car clubs. I've seen like car clubs, lowrider kind of things in this area that are very, without intentionally knowing that they're doing it, are very therapeutic, very supportive. They may not get to some of those obviously deeper issues that they have, but I think that there is opportunity in communities to look at some of those collaborations with non-traditional you know, support that may, as I mentioned, it's not going to be that acute, severe stuff that's obviously going to take, you know, what we're talking about, policy and licensed workers, experts. But I think there is opportunity for to help either prevent or at a very surface level kind of address some of these mental health issues or the roots of them in community. And also, I think that might go a long way towards destigmatizing. I mean, obviously, this is also a long-term kind of thought and whatever, but I just think it's an alternative perspective to what we all, myself included, you know, think about when we think about therapy, mental health, as just those, the models that we're used to seeing. So I thought I'd throw that in there.
You know, I like that because we know, like, if we look at these marginalized communities, like, they're isolated. Like, they don't have the resources in place. And so to build up that community, like, I think you would see a decrease in mental health worsening because having community, we know that if you're in isolation, your mental health is going to be poorer compared to somebody who has positive supports in place. And so I think there would be a benefit to working with those natural supports and bringing people into the community. And then I think that really just creates an atmosphere of advocacy too, because you have people who are seeing what's going on and they get to know the actual people in the community. And you can't really advocate if you don't know who you're advocating for and the struggle. So I actually really like that. And that was pretty sobering for me because I'm like, policy, why, you know, there's problems. But I think we forget sometimes about those simpler solutions that do have real results.
And the good thing, I think, I think the good thing is it's pretty, there are plenty of clinicians, like experts who live in both worlds. There's a, here in California, I don't know if you've heard of him, Sabrina, a man named Jerry Theo. He's he runs a national organization that's rooted in using traditional indigenous approaches to treating mental health and stuff. So he's a, you know, I think he's an LCSW. Him and his team are very professional. They present all over the place and they're very qualified professionally, but they're rooted in those traditional approaches. And they've gone into, he's in Southern California, but he's from everywhere, but they have gone into some of the hardest core neighborhoods and some of those hard, what we would call hardcore, you know, challenging youth or whatever. They've very successfully used those methods to, you know, address that. So I wish we could keep talking on this, but we do have another topic and maybe at a future episode when we have our whole team with us, we can revisit and because it's such a rich area, I think. So any last things though, anyone wants to say before we move on or ready to go?
One last thing. I was just reading this at LA Times or New York Times did an article on the homelessness crisis and how many people are dying because the number of deaths of people who are living on the streets, homelessness have significantly increased. And one of the researchers was saying that the white male population is continuing to have a decline in their lifespan. And she's noticing that a lot of the folks, that like a big part of it is that white males in this conversation don't have the supportive relationships and are not taught to prioritize relationships. And so they don't have the natural family and friend supports. So they're more likely to die without like anybody knowing where they are or like anybody knowing who they are, where women are more likely to have someone who will take them in. You know, they will be able to like contact somebody who cares about them. But for men, they're so isolated that like no one even knows that they're dead and no one really cares because, and I'm sure, of course, their family probably does in fact care, but there is a lack of emphasis on male relationships in general and how men have relationships. And so they're posing that might be part of this really steep increase. And to say also that Black men are dying at higher rates overall. But the, again, kind of just like these trends that are going on are having the white men are dying at younger ages. And so, and a big part of it from a research perspective is a lack of relationship and knowing how to be in relationship with others. And unfortunately, like not having anyone when you end up passing away on the streets. So. So that's my last little thing I just read.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And that's really, it's sad. That's really heartbreaking, the power of a relationship and what that really means for our mortality.
Seriously. And I'm glad you said that, Sabrina, just to finish off, because when we talk, maybe another future topic, when we talk about marginalized communities, what does that mean? We have an idea maybe of what that means, but there's a lot of different, you can call communities, groups,
intersectionality.
Exactly. So future topic for viewers and listeners. So we will move on to our next topic, our second topic, which is we are on, at April 22nd. So for those of you who are in school right now, you see the light at the end of the tunnel, either the year is ending for you, or for some of you, the you're going to be getting your degree, either a BSW or an MSW or maybe some related field, and entering into the workforce. And you know, you may have done some internships, had some experiences, but now for some of you, it's going to get real and your career is starting. And so with that being said, with this time of year and as we transition to graduation season, we wanted to just kind of talk a little bit about what is the reality for social work professionals or human services professionals as they come into the field. What should graduates expect? How should they prepare themselves? You know, maybe the first 3, 6, 9, 12 months of their career. Any advice that either one of you wants to start off with to share with those individuals?
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately because this was my last week of grad school. So I do see the light.
I didn't even know you were in grad school.
Yeah. I'm on my MSSW now. So
nice.
So, you know, and I feel like it's really important for the like BSW level to like, just not that this doesn't impact like the master's therapist level either, but I feel like it's very common that when you are graduating with like your undergraduate, that you're going to be going into direct client work. And I think it is so important. And I know we talk about it all the time, but I can't stress enough, like vicarious trauma is real. Secondary trauma is real. Burnout is real. And you will see it firsthand, very close up. Like when I started in my undergraduate, I saw so, like after I graduated my undergraduate, turnover. I mean, people came in and out of agencies all the time. People who their lifelong dream was to serve this population, but because of the trauma associated with it and their inability or lack of support within their management to like promote self-care, they burnt out and they weren't doing well. And so I just feel like I just want people to really caution themselves and have a plan in place, because it's sad. I've seen workers who are phenomenal and they're amazing. Yeah. And then suddenly it's like, it just builds up. And I've had coworkers who actually became suicidal. Like you have a break. And it's not good. And that's so scary. And we have to take care of ourselves if we want to take care of others and actually help and make a difference. So that's my soapbox, and I'll get off of it. But like, just having seen that, like, I'm like, whoo, like it's real. It's so real. Yeah. Anyway, I'm done. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I can go off of that for like, totally. I can go off that for like 20 minutes. But yeah, I would say obviously like figuring out what your self-care practices are before you even start working is a super important thing. You are just going through a really stressful time right now anyway. So maybe, you know, you can start figuring out some of those. How are you taking care of yourself physically, socially, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually? Those are all important things. Have a practice for each. And also maintaining boundaries. And I think that it's a hard thing to figure out when you first graduate and when you're first working directly with clients. It's hard to figure out what is the appropriate boundary. I always say I can be friendly. I'm not your friend. That is my boundary. You know, and I think that that's a nice way to put it. But I also think that part of that burnout is when we lose our boundaries, and there's a feeling that if I am not there for my client will suffer and my client, something bad will happen to my client. So I have to give more of myself so that my client's okay. We need to be okay. And we deserve to be okay. Like we deserve as social service professionals to be safe and to take care of ourselves and to have boundaries with our clients. So I've seen that kind of be a really challenging thing for folks where there becomes kind of almost that codependency where we say, I have to go to work tomorrow because I'm seeing so-and-so. And if I don't see so-and-so, they're going to lose it. And I don't want them to lose it. Like, no, we have to not lose it too. Mm-hmm. So we have to take care of ourselves with that. Mm-hmm. And kind of just like a couple of other ones is like, know your worth, know your value. You do not have to live in poverty to work in social services. You should not be living in poverty to work in social services. We should not be on Medicaid. We should not be on food stamps. If you are getting your BSW, your MSW, quite frankly, anybody in social services, mm-hmm. I believe no one with a job should be on that. But in social services, we so much focus on putting money towards clients and don't focus on putting money towards the people who are working with clients. And I think that that's, we need to hold our own lines there. We need to push for more pay. We need to not accept jobs that we won't be able to support our families. And also figure out with those student loan payments coming, you need to figure out how much you actually are going to need to, like that was my first job out. I was like, look, this is how much I need to literally pay my rent and pay my student loans and like eat once in a while, you know, like know mathematically what that number is because it's going to be there and it's going to be high and, you know, you need to be able to survive. I'll say those. And then also just remember that social work is not just therapy and child welfare services. Social workers can be in lots of different jobs and it does not have to just be in those two things. And broaden your search, your job search. If you're just searching social worker, it'll probably end up in child welfare somewhere.
Yep.
Or in a school.
Yeah. There's so many things. I feel like people, they do narrow their focus, but like, I mean, you can work in adoption unrelated to the child welfare system. You can work in mental health. You can work in the jail system. There's so many opportunities. So don't limit yourself. But just to piggyback off of what you said, Sabrina, about like the pay, like I'm a firm believer, like, okay, as a social worker, I'm called to advocate for others. So I'm also going to advocate for myself. And I have told people in interviews, like, I need this. This is my bottom line of money. Like, I know maybe that's like a taboo thing. Like, I remember always being told, like, don't ask about pay in interviews or don't ask your coworkers how much they're making. I don't buy it. I'm going to tell them what I need because if they want me and they think my skill set's valuable, then I want to be paid for what I'm worth. And I also want to, you know, not die and be hungry and, you know, like you got to live. And so I think that's such wise advice, like knowing your budget and your finances and what your means are to live within and be able to reflect that in interviews or your cover letters, whatever. So I love that.
First of all, I love your statement and the way you deliver it. I don't buy it. That I'm going to start using that in a number of different scenarios.
I don't buy it. I don't know. Maybe it's a Midwest thing. Like,
I love that. So it's that, but, you know, it's kind of a little bit of repeating what both of you have already said, but I think one thing that new social workers will, it's very important to, as soon as possible, to develop a system of organization and time management. And there's a number of different ways you can do that. You can talk to seasoned, I mean, obviously you'll hopefully will have a supervisor who supports and guides you through some of that. But it's important to identify either peers or maybe more like seasoned workers, like I said, who have developed things. And you don't have to use the system that they use. You can pick and choose things that work for you, work for your style. But I think it's something that you have to be very intentional about. It's not something that you can use haphazardly and just kind of here and there. Like you have to be, if you really want to control your workflow and be able to manage boundaries, you have to, just like anything else, whether it's your health or your education. You have to put attention to the outcome or the thing that you want. You can't, it's not just going to happen by itself. And to the contrary, if you're not intentional about it, it, that's where the overwhelm, I think, comes. Because, you know, as social workers, I think sometimes by our nature, we tend to want to say yes to things. We want to help people. Yeah. We want to support people. And so people come running at us with the hair on fire because they have a crisis and they want support. And so our tendency sometimes is to say, yeah, I'll help you. And we help this person. And then we help this person. And then we help, and then we're over, you know, we're stretched beyond what our capacity is. And now our own stuff is coming up and we don't have the bandwidth to do it. And so it's a little bit of a shameless little plug here, but I'll pop this thing up because I had, you know, in my, with my teams that I work with, there was a, we talked about that. Like, how do you prioritize? Everything seems like it's a priority sometimes, you know, whether, whatever it is, it just seems like everything's a priority. And sometimes I'm of the opinion, and some people feel that this is minimizing the reality of some of the work, but I do think that there are things that are urgent priorities and there are things that are not so much so. They may seem like it on their face when we first are presented with them, but if you objectively think about it, they maybe are not, and they can be put a little further back in your list of priorities. So this is a tool that I'm scrolling here, if you're watching this video, that I developed. I'm open to feedback on it, but it's a way to kind of objectively determine the level of urgency so that you can hopefully prioritize what's really important, crisis level versus kind of social, you know, things that are also important. But, you know, hanging out with friends at lunch to take care of your self-care is not always the urgency level of, you know, someone who ran away from their placement or is suicidal or whatever. I would think obviously those are different. But sometimes when we're confronted with them in the fast-paced environment, everything just blurs. And so that this is a tool to get to that. And if you also, if you go to socialworkmentor.com in the link section, there's another tool of different ways to say no, because I think it's also easy for us to say to have, you know, have boundaries, know your boundaries. But when your supervisor's telling you that you need to do this and the court is telling you, like, all these people are telling you all these different things, it's not always easy to put up a boundary and say no. So there's some tools there for you also that hopefully are kind of like win-win situations, providing alternatives to tasks and asking. They're just different ways to say no and create boundaries. So to finish off my little part here, it's really about intentionality. When you enter the field, be intentional about the, you know, to your points, the career you want for yourself, the boundaries you want to set for yourself, the priorities that you have for yourself as a person, not as a social worker. Be very intentional from the get-go, and don't let the career define who you are, define who you want to be, and then move forward in your career. I think that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, that's good. I also, it's like, one of the things I always say is that if everything's a priority, then nothing is priority.
Exactly.
Like, that's a huge thing, is like, you can't actually have more than two or three priorities ever in anything. And so, you know, really understanding what that prioritization looks like. And even when you were talking about like ways to say no nicely, that's one of the ways that I always train people to say no, is to say, where, okay, great, I'm happy to do that. Where does that fit in the priority list compared to the three? Like, here are the other things that are on my to-do list for right now. Where does that land in this? And, or which one of these do you need me to take off? And then that usually catches someone's attention, where you say, well, everything has to be on. And you're like, well, that's not possible. No. Well, you're just like, oh, well, that's actually not how this works. So, so that's always what I say is like,
yeah.
Okay, great. Happy to help you with that. Where does that fall on my prioritization list, and what can come off, or what can I move to, you know, the end of the week to make time for this to be the priority? And then the person has to make that choice. You know, the other person has to realize, like,
exactly.
You know, that's
fair. And when you work in, I think when you work in an organization or a bureaucracy, it's important to, I call it training the system. Like, if you say yes to everything all the time, the system, I mean, obviously the system is made up of individuals, but I just say the system, the system learns that there's capacity here. This can be done. We don't need to address this. There's no issue. So as workers say yes and become overburdened and overburdened, the system just rolls because it's working. But if it's hard, it's not easy to do. But if we as individuals can learn to put up those boundaries and do it in a way like Sabrina was talking about, a very productive, you know, nice way, then the system, we train the system that there's not resources here. We need to address this. We don't have the capacity to handle the things that need to happen. So let's put attention to that. Again, it's easier said than done, and no guarantee that the system will respond in that way. But what's the alternative? I mean, training the system that all is well.
That doesn't go well. I don't know. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say with organization, I think that's really helpful too. Like knowing, okay, so I work in a large system type organization. And so having a good organization, I feel like for like a management perspective also really, if like everybody's kind of using the same, I don't know, like some way to track it from like a supervisor management, you also see where your bottlenecks are in your unit. And you're like, I'm giving them too many cases and then they're never getting their paperwork done. Well, then you got a problem. So I feel like there's benefits to using that at different levels of your social work career too. So I don't know, it's good to find a good system that works for you. And anyway, that was my little tidbit. But
I also wanted to kind of echo another thing that you had said, Sabrina, that I think is important. When you're entering the field, I have found that there's more before, like 10, 15, 20 years ago, I saw that there was two kinds of people, usually two kinds of social workers, those who got into a position and that was their passion. They loved it. They never left. Like they literally had 30-year careers in investigations or in as a school social, whatever it is, like that was their thing. They stayed. That's awesome if that's your thing and it makes you happy and content professionally. But I've noticed as the years have gone on, and even in those days, there are also those who, I'm one of them, who 5, 6, 7 years, maybe, like I start itching for a little change. And so early on in your career, I think it's important to the extent possible to determine, you know, do you really just have this burning fire to whatever, work with certain populations or in certain environments, and that's your thing, and then dedicate yourself to that and become the expert in that area. But there are also, if you're not of that ilk, I always want to use that word. I don't know if I use it right.
That's good.
Another grammar reference here. But if you're not of that ilk, you know, test, like Sabrina was saying, like look around and explore and try things out. Internships always are great for that, obviously, and volunteer opportunities. But even professionally, like, you know, see what your thing is. If you get into a position and you enjoy it, but maybe you have interest elsewhere, don't be afraid to go in a different direction and try something new, because as we all have said, social workers, the skill sets that we have, I mean, they in human services, in social services, there's a million opportunities, but also like in the private sector and in a whole bunch of different areas that you wouldn't necessarily think, there's opportunities for what we have to bring to the table as well. So if you're dedicated to what you want to do, become that expert. But if you're curious, don't be afraid to test the waters in other areas.
Yeah. I went into my like first more professional social services job. I went to a large international organization because my thing was, okay, I could do this job super easy. And homeless services really wasn't, and like, you know, kind of working in the poverty space wasn't my area of interest. But I was like, this is a giant organization. And so if I'm lucky, I can move, you know, you can think like that, like, okay, so maybe I want to work in this population. I can get a job that is in that organization, but not necessarily doing exactly what I want. It's a lot easier to move within organizations than to move like, you know, complete jobs. The other thing I would say is it's a lot easier to move within fields of practice. And so even if, say, like you're not super into schools, but you do really want to work with children, just not in that setting, it's a lot easier to start, you know, get the job where you can get the job, quite frankly. Get the experience that can get you to where you want to go. So one of the things that I always, when I'm doing like mentorship, which everyone should get a mentor, you can sneakily do it too. They don't have to know that you're their mentor. That's how I get all of mine. I just start calling them and inviting them to coffee often enough that they sooner or later get the picture that they're my mentor, but it's like a year after and then they can't back out from there. So mentors are great. I love them. But the other thing I would say is, when you are looking for like kind of those first couple of jobs, the thing I always say is look for the job that is the dream job that you want to do in 10 years. Where do you want to be? You know, if you think like this, some people are like, Sabrina, I could care less where I am in 10 years. And that's fine too. But if you are the kind of person who's like, I know that I want to run this type of organization, or I know that I want to be doing this type of social work, find that job description and work backwards. Because I can't tell you how many times people will go get a degree or go get training or go work a job that they think is going to get them where they want to go. And then 5 years later, they realize that they didn't take the steps they should have when they first got out of school to get there. And so I will just say, like, when I would look at jobs that I was really interested in doing, like in the future, most of them are like executive director jobs. And, you know, like, obviously I'm like the policy dork. So like running for Congress, whatever I do, you know, all of those things. I looked at like, what are those job descriptions? And none of them had anything about being licensed. None of the jobs that I really want to do in my life will ever require a license. And so I knew where I needed to invest my time and energy and resources was not in licensure, because that's not something that I'm into. And so that's not the goal later on. And so know what, you know, if you have an idea of like, my dream job is to do this, look at as many job descriptions for that dream job that you can find and work backwards for your career path. So then you're not like surprised when they say you only needed a bachelor's and there you went and got a doctorate and thought that that was what you needed, but that's useless because you've never done anything in business and they want someone who has business background. So definitely use that to guide what you're going to do next.
You know, I wish that back in my day, 30 years ago or whatever, I wish that this show existed, or I wish I just would have been wise enough as to the think about things in the way you're talking about, Sabrina, because at that time, you know, I'm lucky that I've landed this far into my career somewhere where I am happy and enjoy the work that I do. But I didn't, I mean, you could take me as kind of the lesson of what not to do. I didn't plan my career at all. Like this is a little anecdote. It's ridiculous, but I'll share it about myself. So I went initially to call my whole life. I knew I wanted to be a wildlife biologist because I love animals. I still love the outdoors and animals. That's what I wanted to be. So I went to school for that, specifically to a school in California for that, because they were a good school. And I got there and I realized math. And so it wasn't for me at that time. But at the same time, I was taking sociology classes, social work, social science, criminal justice, ethnic studies. And I loved that. And I was good at it. So I decided to change my major, but I didn't know what to change it to. And so I chose sociology simply because I was taking a sociology class that I liked. But to me, sociology just sounded better. It just sounded more important, more professional. So that's literally how I designed my undergrad. And then when I, again, this is ridiculous. I literally graduated. I walked the stage and I got my degree. And like the next Saturday, was sitting on the porch at my friend's house drinking beers. And my friend's like, so what are you going to do now? I feel so stupid saying this. I was like, I don't know. What am I? Like, I had zero plan, zero anything.
And it happens.
A friend of mine, sister, worked for the organization, the you know, where I currently work. And she got me an interview at a very, very entry level position. And I've been able to work my way up. Yeah. But, you know, I did not in any way, shape, or form design my career. It ended up okay, but do not, boys and girls, young ladies, young men, do not follow my example and choose careers because they sound good or they just happen to fall in your lap. Because it's probably not going to end as well.
I mean, I think we all get to where we're going eventually. It's just nice if you can kind of be able to design the ride a little bit more for yourself.
At least a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, sociology does sound cooler than social work, though. I mean, just the word itself. So yeah.
I'm a social worker and a sociologist. Ooh, I'm an ologist.
A scientist.
So to kind of close it off, we're at about an hour, which is what I think we had wanted to get to for this episode. So any last things about advice or anything for new workers entering the field? I'll start with one that's just more down and dirty, kind of, I don't know about grimy, that word popped into my head, but I came into the field kind of thinking that social workers are going to be so evolved and everyone was going to be just so professional and we're going to, you know, this is such a very high level thing. And I got there and there's still, part of my friends, they're still assholes. You know, they're still jerks. There's great people and there's not so great people as in any profession. We're just people. Yep. So if you're getting into the field, if you have the perception that I did, that social workers, because of what we do and our, you know, everything that we're about, we're still not all, you know, there's also another side to that coin, I guess. So be conscious that there's cliques. There's people that maybe aren't going to treat you well, and you just either avoid them or find a way to work with them and find your people, find your tribe, and create your own clique if you need to for support.
Yeah. I like that. There should be like a shirt that says like some social workers are assholes.
Right?
I'm glad you're
included. Maybe I can be.
Depends on what day it is.
Yeah, I would say like that, going back to that cultural humility piece, right? Like we are constantly having to work on ourselves and learn. And I would also say follow BIPOC creators, like BIPOC social work creators and or whatever field you end up going into, whether it's like social welfare or if you're going into, you know, kind of the homelessness space, whatever space, make sure you are listening to people who do not look like you, or if you're, you know, a person of color and that do look like you, but make sure that we are taking, and people with lived experience, like make sure we are taking all of that information in as much as you can, because that's the part we're not taught. And that's the part that we need to hear most of the time.
Absolutely. I just will quickly piggyback off of that. The lived experience part, it's huge. Like I follow a lot of advocacy creators who have been kids in the foster care system or parents who've lost children to the system. And their experiences are valid. And no matter the research or the stats or what, you know, the
professionalization of it,
whatever, like their experience is valid and they need to be heard. And that's how you become better. And that's how you create change. So yes, amen to that.
Perfect way to end today's show. Well, thank you both for being here. I think we had some great discussions. Hopefully if you're watching or listening, you found this valuable. And know that in 2 weeks, we hopefully will be back with the same crew or a different crew, but the crew will be here with different topics and other things to cover from all these different social work perspectives. So thanks again for watching. You might not know, but this is the third week in a row that we've had some technical difficulties. At some point, we're going to get this right, but we ended it. We finished it. We're good to go for the next episode, number 4. So thanks, everyone. Thank you, Destry. Thank you, Sabrina. And until next time, it's the world's best social work show.